Imagine, just for a second, waking up one morning and turning on the TV,
Okay.
and you find out that your absolute favorite sports team has completely changed. Like they've ripped up the entire playbook.
Right.
They've traded away literally all their star players for, a completely different kind of
A
athlete.
total overhaul.
Exactly. They've even swapped out the iconic team colors that you've been wearing since you were a little kid. But and here's the kicker, right now,
Yeah.
they kept the exact same name.
Wow. Yeah.
Same logo on the stadium, same name on the tickets, but everything happening on the field is fundamentally, undeniably different.
It's basically a completely different team playing under the old banner.
Exactly. And that brings us to the exact question driving our deep dive today. How does a team change its entire identity but keep the name? Because we are looking into the staggering transformation of the Republican Party from 2015 to 2029. We're opening up Dossier Trump 2015-2029, specifically Chapter 4, which covers this massive model shift.
It really is probably one of the most disorienting phenomena in modern political history. I mean, you're looking at an institution that felt entirely familiar to people,
Right.
but the mechanical engine operating underneath was just, it was completely swapped out for something totally alien to its original design.
Yeah. And just before we get too deep into the engine swap, we should probably set some ground rules for you, the listener.
Definitely.
Today's deep dive is going to keep things fairly light, very accessible, and free of dense political jargon. So whether you're a political science student or just, a curious grandparent, this is for you.
And critically, we need to state our impartiality pledge right at the top.
Yes, very important.
This deep dive is a strictly impartial, objective look at the source material in the dossier. We are not here to take sides. We aren't endorsing any policies, and we aren't validating the political viewpoints of either the left or the right.
Right, our goal is purely to understand the mechanics of this transformation exactly as laid out in the text. We're just looking at the blueprint. Exactly, just the blueprint.
So our roadmap for today, we're starting with the classic foundations, then we'll look at the economic cracks that started to form, we'll analyze the whole populist takeover,
Yeah.
and finally ask, what this means for the future of the globe.
It's a big journey.
It is. So to understand how we get to that total engine swap, we have to know what the original machine looked like.
Right, you have to know the baseline.
For decades, the Republican Party operated on a very specific, incredibly successful blueprint, the Reagan model.
Yeah, the Reagan era, which, profoundly dominated the party's DNA throughout the 1980s, the 90s, and well into the 2000s. And it wasn't just like a political strategy. No, it was a comprehensive worldview. It rested on four main pillars. The first, and arguably the most load-bearing pillar, was economic freedom.
Okay, let's unpack this, because economic freedom sounds like a catchy campaign slogan, but what did it actually mean mechanically?
Mechanically, it meant a strict, almost dogmatic adherence to lower taxes.
And the aggressive slashing of government regulation. It was a constant championing of capital and entrepreneurship.
So basically, supply-side economics.
Exactly. The belief that if you remove bureaucratic friction, and free up the flow of capital at the top, prosperity just naturally cascades down through the entire system.
The idea that the government's only real job in the economy is to basically just get out of the way.
Pretty much, yeah.
So if your first pillar is unlocking all this domestic capital and building these massive corporate engines, I'm guessing your second pillar has to be about finding places to sell all those products, right? You need the rest of the world.
You do.
Yeah.
Which brings us directly to the second pillar, which is free trade.
Okay.
This is where the classic model aggressively supported international economic cooperation. It advocated for tearing down borders, at least when it came to commerce.
Right, fully embracing globalization.
Yes, the mechanical assumption here was that interconnected global economies were not just highly profitable, but they were actually pacifying.
Pacifying,
Right.
like creating peace.
Yeah, if nations are inextricably linked through supply chains, the cost of going to war becomes mathematically ruinous. You just can't afford to bomb the country that makes all your microchips.
Ah, I see. It's the old capitalism brings peace theory.
Precisely. But of course, you don't just trust that theory blindly, right?
Right, which I assume leads to the third pillar.
Exactly. A
Right.
strong defense. And this wasn't merely about having, a capable
It
military.
was about projecting power.
Yes, a massive, globally projecting military posture, peace through overwhelming strength. It relied really heavily on American international influence and the robust support of international alliances.
Like NATO.
Exactly like NATO. The logic is you police the global shipping lanes so the free trade can actually happen safely.
Okay, so we have economic freedom, free trade, and a strong defense to police it all. But honestly, that all sounds very, I don't know, very corporate.
It is very spreadsheet-driven.
Yeah, right. It's a spreadsheet. A political party needs a soul, or at least some kind of cultural anchor, to actually get everyday people to the voting booth. You can't just campaign on supply chains.
And that is the final pillar, traditional values.
Ah, there it is.
This is what grounded those economic and military policies in a relatable cultural framework.
So what did that look like in practice?
It placed a heavy emphasis on the nuclear family, the protection of religious freedom, and fostering a strong sense of local community.
Got it.
It essentially provided the moral architecture that made the harsh competitive realities of free market capitalism palatable to the average voter.
Okay, I like to think in analogy. So looking at this baseline, economic freedom, strong defense, free trade, and traditional values, it sounds exactly like a highly successful corporate franchise model.
A franchise model, I like that.
Yeah, think of a massive globally recognized brand like, I don't know, a McDonald's or a Hilton. It's deeply optimistic, it's incredibly globally minded, and its entire focus is on limitless expansion. You standardize the product, right? Free markets, strong alliances, predictable laws.
Mm-hmm.
And then you open locations everywhere, from Berlin to Tokyo. The assumption is that everybody on Earth fundamentally wants this exact same product.
That is actually a very accurate way to visualize it.
Right.
It was a standardized, exportable ideology.
And it felt like it was winning.
Oh, absolutely. We have to understand the psychological environment this blueprint created. This foundation generated an almost unshakable aura of elite optimism.
Elite optimism.
Yeah. The entire architecture was built on the fundamental belief in the old macroeconomic adage, you know, that a rising tide lifts all boats.
Globally.
If global wealth increases, if trade volume expands, the theory dictates that everyone from the CEO in Manhattan to the factory line worker in Ohio will eventually see their standard of living improve.
So, if this formula was so incredibly successful in the 80s and 90s, if this franchise model was posting record profits on a global scale, why would anyone ever want to mess with the recipe?
That's the million-dollar question.
Right, because you don't just abandon a winning playbook. If you are selling billions of burgers, you don't suddenly decide to brain the restaurant down and only sell tacos.
No, you definitely don't.
So why did they?
Well, the disconnect between the macroeconomic theory and the microeconomic reality is where this whole transformation actually starts.
Okay, so while the rising tide looked great from the yacht, the people rowing the dinghies were starting to take on water.
That's a perfect way to put it. It is the absolute core of the fracture. At the dawn of the 21st century, the realities on the ground began to diverge violently from the optimistic theories of the 1980s.
Violent divergence. How so?
The great blind spot of the Reagan franchise model was that globalization did not only produce winners, it produced distinct, highly concentrated, and quantifiable losers.
Okay, let's break that down mechanically for the listener. What does losing at globalization actually look like? Because, you know, reading a phrase like stagnating wage growth in an economics textbook sounds clinical.
It sounds like a rounding error.
Exactly. It sounds like a rounding error on a spreadsheet.
Yeah.
But what was the reality?
To understand the pain, we really have to look at the mechanism of global labor arbitrage.
Right, labor arbitrage.
Right. When free trade policies rapidly expanded, most notably with China's integration into the World Trade Organization in 2001, it didn't just open up a new market for American goods.
Right. It works both ways.
Exactly. It exposed the American industrial worker to direct, unfiltered competition with a labor force that was paid a fraction of their wages.
Wow.
And that overseas labor force was operating under practically zero environmental or worker safety regulations.
So the multinational corporations that the Republican Party had been championing looked at this and said, wait, why pay a guy in Michigan $25 an hour when I can pay someone overseas $2 a day?
Exactly. And the capital flowed exactly as the free market pillar dictated it should. It flowed toward the highest point of efficiency.
But the localized result in America was devastation.
Total devastation. Entire industrial regions began hemorrhaging jobs. The manufacturing base that had sustained middle-class life in the Rust Belt was systematically hollowed out. Production relocated overseas.
And what about the people who didn't lose their jobs?
Well, crucially, even for those American workers who managed to keep their jobs in other sectors, wage growth just flatlined.
Because the threat was always there?
Right. because the perpetual threat of outsourcing destroyed the bargaining power of labor. So paychecks remained stagnant, but the cost of healthcare, housing, and education skyrocketed.
This is where those clinical terms really fail. I mean, it is a profoundly visceral experience to watch your town's main factory board up its windows.
Oh, absolutely.
You see the parking lot empty out. Then the local diner closes because the shift workers aren't coming in for lunch anymore.
Yeah, it cascades.
Exactly. Then the property taxes plummet, so the local school loses its funding. Finally, you realize your kids have to move 1,000 miles away just to find decent work.
It isn't just an economic downturn at that point.
Yeah.
It is the death of a community.
It's deep generational trauma.
It's a systemic collapse of a way of life. And this economic trauma did not exist in a vacuum, you know. It began to breed a very deep, pervasive, and highly targeted frustration.
Targeted at who, exactly?
Aimed directly at the establishment that built the machine. The architects of these international trade agreements, the powerful lobby groups in Washington, and the designers of open immigration policies that increased competition for lower wage jobs at home.
So people felt betrayed.
Yes. There was a coalescing, undeniable feeling among these working class voters that the political elites, and this is regardless of whether they had an R or a D next to their name, were entirely disconnected from their everyday anxieties.
But wait, I have to ask about the traditional Republican leadership here. Were the traditional Republicans the ones still running the old Reagan playbook? Were they just actively ignoring these cracks?
Yeah.
Like, did their philosophy simply not have an answer for them? Were they looking out the window at the boarded up factories and just shrugging?
What's fascinating here is that it wasn't necessarily malicious neglect. It was a fundamental blind spot inherent in their ideological operating system.
Meaning what?
As we established, classic conservatism relies on macroeconomics. It treats the national economy like a giant math equation.
Okay.
If a new free trade agreement eliminates 50,000 factory jobs in Ohio, but it increases the overall GDP of the United States by 2% because consumer goods are cheaper nationwide.
The math says it's a win.
The mathematical model says that is a net positive. It's a good policy.
Wow. So classic conservatism treated the American economy like a math equation. But to the voters, the economy is more like a moral contract.
That's a great distinction.
And when the math worked for Wall Street, but the contract felt broken on Main Street, the model literally didn't have the vocabulary to address their specific pain.
That is exactly the mechanism of the failure. To fix the problem of a dying factory town, traditional party leaders would consult the old blueprint and suggest the same old solution.
Like tax cuts.
Right, like lowering the corporate tax rate or reducing environmental regulations to spur growth. But if your local factory's entire supply chain has already permanently relocated to Shenzhen, a marginal tax cut in Ohio doesn't bring it back.
Right. The factory's gone. It doesn't care about a tax cut.
Exactly. And this disconnect created a massive expanding vulnerability within the Republican Party's own base. The very people who relied on the party to champion their traditional cultural values felt completely economically abandoned by the party's free market absolutism.
So you have this massive base of voters feeling ignored, watching their livelihoods vanish, while the politicians in expensive suits on TV are telling them the economy is doing great because the stock market hit a record high.
It was maddening for them.
I can imagine. The frustration was basically a dry forest, completely parched, just waiting. And as the dossier outlines, a political vacuum never stays empty for long.
No, it doesn't.
In 2015, a very specific, very bright spark was thrown right into the middle of it.
The entry of Donald Trump into the 2015 primary. That is the undeniable inflection point where this simmering frustration found its voice.
Let's look at the actual mechanism of that, because he don't just tweak the edges of the platform, did he?
Oh, no. He took a sledgehammer to the load-bearing pillars.
Right.
His core message was a direct, unapologetic rebuttal to the Reagan consensus. He argued that America wasn't leading the global economy. It was trapped in bad, exploitative trade deals that were hollowing out the country.
A total reversal.
Completely. He argued that national borders weren't just lines on a map to be managed. They were unprotected vulnerabilities being exploited.
Yeah.
He stated plainly that the political elites had catastrophically failed the working class. And perhaps most radically for a Republican, he argued that international obligations and military adventurism were actively crushing national interests.
He essentially looked at the free trade and strong defense pillars and declared them structurally unsound.
Yes.
But it wasn't just the policy that shifted. It was the entire method of delivery, right? Like the communication shift.
The shift in communication style is just as critical as the policy shift. The dossier highlights this really well. Traditional Republicans were still standing on debate stages, lecturing about abstract economic theories.
Like the Laffer curve and stuff.
Exactly, talking about the long-term benefits of global market efficiencies. Trump bypassed the theory entirely. He spoke directly to the concrete, tangible, immediate worries of the citizens.
It's the difference between, think of it like a doctor coming into your hospital room and explaining the complex biochemistry of why you have a headache.
Right, talking about vasodilation and neurotransmitter reuptake.
Yeah, exactly. Versus someone just walking in, looking at you in pain, and handing you an aspirin and a glass of water.
That's a really good analogy.
One is theoretically accurate, sure, but the other actually acknowledges and addresses your immediate suffering.
It's a very powerful distinction. Traditional politicians were offering biochemistry lessons to a base that was in intense economic agony. Trump offered the aspirin.
But I want to push back on that analogy for a second.
Okay.
Was it actually an aspirin? Or was it just a placebo? Like, did this blunt, concrete rhetoric actually fix the structural changes of globalization? Did it bring the factories back in a permanent way, or did it just validate their anger and make them feel heard while the macroeconomic realities basically stayed the same?
Well, that is the pivotal historical debate, right? And the dossier remains objective on this. Critics argue it was entirely a placebo.
Okay.
They argue that tariffs and border walls couldn't reverse the unstoppable momentum of automation in global supply chains. They say the manufacturing jobs that returned were just a fraction of what was lost.
And the proponents.
Proponents argue it was absolutely an aspirin because it finally stopped the bleeding. It forced the renegotiation of trade deals, like replacing NAFTA with the USMCA, and it shattered the bipartisan consensus that unregulated free trade was untouchable.
Right. But politically, whether it was a cure or a placebo didn't even matter, did it?
No. What mattered was the bedside manner. He acknowledged the pain that the traditionalists were telling the voters they shouldn't even be feeling.
So how did that directness fundamentally short-circuit the traditional Republican debate stage? I mean, in 2015, Trump was up against seasoned, deeply entrenched political professionals, governors, senators, people with hundreds of millions of dollars in backing. How did they lose the room so incredibly fast?
Because the rules of political combat they were trained in relied on a shared agreement.
Yeah.
They all agreed that classic conservatism was the baseline reality.
Okay.
Think about how a primary debate normally works. If an opponent attacked Trump by saying his protectionist tariff ideas violated free market principles, the traditionalist expected the audience to gasp and turn on him.
Like, oh no, he's against the free market.
Exactly.
Right.
But it didn't land. The voters he was speaking to no longer cared about textbook free market principles.
Right.
They cared about their closed factories. By entirely rejecting the premise of the classic model, he rendered the traditional attacks completely inert.
It's like bringing a rule book to a street fight. You're complaining that the other guy is hitting below the belt, and the crowd is just cheering for him precisely because he doesn't care about your rules.
Exactly. And the 2016 victory was the ultimate proof of concept for this. It definitively proved that a massive portion of the Republican base was not just open to, but desperate for, a fundamental rewrite of the party's priorities. The old blueprint was suddenly obsolete.
So we've moved from the shift in communication, from polite theory to blunt, concrete grievance. But this wasn't just a change in tone or an aesthetic rebranding.
No, not at all.
This represented a tectonic ideological collision between two very different isms battling for the soul of the same institution.
Yeah.
Let's really look at this collision. Classic conservatism versus populism.
Right. To understand the depth of this civil war, we have to precisely define the mechanics of these two competing ideologies, as detailed in the source.
Let's start with classic conservatism.
Classic conservatism, often referred to in academic circles as Burkean conservatism, prioritizes institutional stability above almost everything else.
Okay.
It believes in limited government, yes, but it also places a massive premium on the slow, deliberate adherence to constitutional principles, the rule of law, and established norms. It views rapid change, even change driven by popular demand, as inherently dangerous.
And populism, how does the mechanism of populism operate? Because that word gets thrown around a lot.
It does. Populism operates on an entirely different axis. Mm-hmm. It isn't inherently left-wing or right-wing. It is a structural framework that divides society into two antagonistic groups, the pure people and the corrupt elite.
Us versus them.
Exactly. It champions the raw, direct representation of the people's will. It features sharp, aggressive attacks on established institutions, arguing that those institutions have been hijacked by a self-serving ruling class. And crucially, it relies on direct, unfiltered political communication that bypasses traditional media or party gatekeepers.
Okay, let me frame this for the listener with an analogy. Imagine classic conservatism as the strict referee upholding the rules of the game.
Okay.
The referee trusts the rule book, right? While populism is the star player grabbing the microphone to say the game itself is rigged against the fans.
I like that. Or, if we use a tech analogy, think of classic conservatism like a legacy operating system on a computer, like an old, incredibly stable version of Windows or macOS.
Okay, yeah.
It has strict rules, it requires passwords for everything, it hates unauthorized changes, and it prioritizes systemic stability over user convenience. It trusts the code.
So what's populism in that scenario?
Populism isn't just a new app you install in that system. Populism is a hacker bypassing the operating system entirely. It rewrites the core code in real time based on what the furious users in the forums are screaming for. It views the operating system's rules not as a protection, but as a prison.
Wow. Conservatism trusts the system to manage the passions of the crowd. Populism trusts the passions of the crowd to overthrow a corrupt system.
Exactly. That is the mechanical difference.
So what actually happens when you force both of these operational realities into the same political party? Does one just instantly overwrite the other?
No. And this is where the nuance is vital. Classic conservative ideas didn't vanish entirely from the Republican Party overnight. You still saw heavy elements of it, particularly when it came to the appointment of judges who adhered to strict constitutional originalism.
Or the passing of traditional corporate tax cuts, right?
Exactly. However, their position in the hierarchy plummeted. They were subordinated.
Right. Cultural and national questions suddenly eclipsed economic theories.
This is the key mechanical shift. If a free market policy conflicted with a nationalist priority, the nationalist priority won out.
Give me an example of that.
Well, for decades, if a conservative politician suggested government intervention to block a corporation from moving to Mexico, they would be laughed out of the room as a socialist.
Right. The government shouldn't pick winners and losers.
Exactly. But under the new populist framework, that same intervention was cheered as heroic protection of the American worker.
This has to explain the sheer agony of the traditional party leaders trying to navigate this era.
Oh, it was paralyzing for them. Imagine being a leader who had spent 30 years perfectly memorizing and defending the classic conservative rulebook. Suddenly, you find yourself in a party that is actively hostile to that rulebook.
Yeah, that's got to cause some whiplash.
If you defended free trade on principle, you were immediately branded an out-of-touch globalist elitist by your own voters. But if you embraced populism and protectionism, you were betraying the lifelong ideological principles that got you into politics in the first place.
It was the ultimate political identity crisis.
Absolutely.
But raw populist energy, just yelling that the system is broken, isn't enough to sustain a governing coalition, is it? It has to eventually materialize into a concrete policy framework. It has to be branded.
Yes, it needs substance.
So how did this abstract idea of populism actually materialize into policy and party branding? Because the answer to that is the most powerful political force of the decade.
Right. Nationalism.
Yeah.
And the America First doctrine.
Yes, America First. It is a phrase that completely saturated the global consciousness. But what are the actual mechanical gears of this doctrine? How is it defined beyond just being a catchy rally cry?
The mechanics of nationalism in this specific context rely on a shift from a positive-sum view of the world to a zero-sum view.
Explain that difference.
The old Reagan pillar of free trade believed in positive-sum games, meaning if America and China trade, both economies grow and everybody wins.
The rising tide.
Right. The America First doctrine views global relations primarily as a zero-sum competition. If another country is winning, it means America is actively losing.
It's the return to almost a 19th century mercantile logic.
Exactly. It demanded the aggressive protection of national interests above all abstract global ideals. It emphasized strict national sovereignty, demanding that international bodies like the UN, the WTO, or even climate accords have zero regulatory power over domestic American affairs.
It called for highly militarized, drastically stricter borders, right?
Yes. And fundamentally, it promised to prioritize the American industrial worker over the theoretical efficiencies of the global supply chain.
And the policy impact of this was immediate. It wasn't just campaign rhetoric that faded once the election was over.
Well, the implementation was profound and disruptive. It completely overhauled trade policy. They utilized tariffs not just as a minor economic tool, but as a primary weapon of statecraft.
Right.
It initiated renegotiations of massive foundational agreements. It impacted defense by fundamentally questioning the utility and cost of permanent overseas military deployments.
And immigration.
It radically reshaped immigration enforcement, and it transformed diplomacy, shifting from a cooperative alliance-building model to a highly transactional bilateral approach. The guiding metric for every single decision became brutally simple. What is the immediate, measurable benefit to the United States?
Now, ensuring balanced representation as dictated by the dossier, we need to look at this objectively. We need to dissect how this doctrine was viewed from both inside the House and outside the House. Walk me through the defense of America First and then the prosecution against it.
Let's start with the proponents. To its defenders, the America First doctrine was a desperately needed, long overdue firewall.
Okay.
They viewed the previous 30 years of unchecked globalization as a slow motion bleeding out of American sovereignty and industrial capacity. They argue that the elites had basically sold off the American middle class to the highest foreign bidder in the name of corporate profits.
So it was a rescue mission to them.
Exactly. America First was seen as the righteous restoration of national control. It was a necessary correction to put the citizens of the country back at the center of their own government's priorities.
If the global network is a computer virus draining your battery, you don't negotiate with it, you install a firewall and disconnect. That's the proponent view. What is the critic's view?
Critics viewed the exact same policies and saw a catastrophic self-sabotage. They warned that this aggressive brand of nationalism was severely hampering international cooperation.
By alienating allies.
Yes, isolating the United States and fundamentally destabilizing the global security architectures that had prevented a major world war since 1945. They feared that by abandoning a cooperative leadership role, the U.S. was creating a massive global power vacuum.
And authoritarian regimes would just happily fill that vacuum.
Exactly, making the world infinitely more dangerous.
It forces a philosophical question that goes way deeper than tariff percentages on imported steel.
It really does. The core question underlying this entire era, posed directly by the text, is what does it actually mean to be American? Or really, to be a nation state in a globalized world?
Yeah.
Is a country defined by its commitment to universal democratic ideals and global leadership? Or is it defined by physical borders, protected industries, and a highly specific defensive national identity?
Here is where it gets really interesting. You see a phrase like America First go from what critics initially dismissed as a throwaway slogan to a deeply entrenched, inescapable political doctrine. It became the sun that the rest of the political system had to orbit.
It really did.
Even the fiercest opponents of this movement had to reckon with it. They couldn't just ignore it. They found themselves constantly having to prove that they weren't selling out the American worker, or they had to adopt Buy American provisions in their own legislation just to stay competitive.
It entirely shifted the Overton window.
Yeah.
You know, the range of policies politically acceptable to the mainstream population.
But let me ask you a chicken and egg question.
Okay, shoot.
Did America First change the party, or did it just give a name to what the voters already wanted? Did it alter the DNA of the Republican Party, or did it just provide a megaphone for a mutation that had already happened at the cellular level?
The structural analysis indicates it was heavily the latter. Donald Trump did not invent the economic anxieties of the Rust Belt. He did not invent the frustration with endless overseas wars or the cultural unease with rapid demographic changes.
Right.
Those forces were already brewing intensely due to the perceived failures of the classic model. What he did was provide the exact vocabulary and the explicit permission structure for voters to embrace a nationalism that the traditional party elites had previously forbidden them from expressing.
He didn't build the fire. He just found the room completely soaked in gasoline and decided he was the only one willing to light the match.
That's a good way to look at it.
And when you change the product that drastically, when you stop selling the optimistic free trade franchise model and start selling the hardline protective firewall, your customer base inevitably changes. A new playbook attracts a different crowd to the stadium.
Yes, it does.
Which brings us to the great reshuffle, this seismic shift in voter coalitions.
This is where we see the demographic realignment that has come to define modern American politics. Under this populist transformation, the actual composition of the Republican base underwent a massive structural reshuffle.
Let's look at the ledger. Let's look at the inflows and the outflows. Who walked into the party and who walked out?
On the side of gains, the party saw a historic influx of support from blue-collar workers, from rural areas, and specifically from voters without university degrees.
Okay.
This is the demographic that felt the microeconomic pain of globalization most acutely, and they abandoned their historical ties to the Democratic Party to embrace the new populist protectionism. The Republican Party essentially became the party of the working class.
The folks in the boarded-up factory towns who finally felt someone was handing them an aspirin?
Exactly.
And the outflows. Who left?
Simultaneously, the party began to rapidly lose support among highly educated voters and within affluent suburban areas.
Interesting.
These were often the precise demographic groups that had benefited the most from the macroeconomic growth of the traditional model.
Yeah.
They were the management class. They valued institutional stability, polite political norms, and international cooperation.
And they didn't like the new tone.
No. They found the raw, chaotic energy of populism deeply repellent.
It is exactly like a tech company pivoting its entire target demographic.
Yeah.
Imagine a software company that for 30 years made sleek, very polite, incredibly expensive enterprise software for corporate managers in the suburbs.
Okay.
Then, almost overnight, they stop selling to the suburban corporate managers and start selling exclusively to the factory floor.
Right.
You gain a fiercely loyal, massive new market of people who actually build things, but your old corporate clients in the suburbs cancel their subscriptions in disgust.
And that profound pivot created an incredible amount of internal friction. Because a political party isn't just its voters. It's elected officials, its donors, its strategists.
So they were fighting each other.
Constantly. The party fractured into distinct factions that spent the entire decade battling for the soul and the steering wheel of the GOP.
Map out the combatants in this civil war for me. Who is fighting who?
Broadly, the dossier maps out three distinct groups. First, you have the traditionalists.
Okay, the old guard.
Right, these are the holdovers from the Reagan era. They are the institutionalists, desperately clinging to the ideals of free trade, fiscal conservatism, and international alliances. They represent the old corporate software model, in your analogy. They view the populist takeover as a temporary fever that they just need to survive.
Got it. Group two.
The populists, or the Trump supporters? This group pushes the new agenda with absolute purity. Aggressive nationalism, economic protection, strict immigration control, and a demand for direct democratic legitimacy.
And how do they view the traditionalists?
They view the traditionalists not as allies, but as part of the corrupt elite establishment that needs to be purged.
Wow. And the third group caught in the crossfire.
The pragmatists. And this is arguably the most stressed, exhausted group in modern politics. They're the party leadership, the whips, the legislative managers.
The ones trying to actually run the government.
Exactly. They spent the entire decade desperately trying to glue the two sides together. They are attempting to find workable compromises between a voting base that demands pure populist disruption and a donor class or institutional memory that still prefers classic conservative stability.
But let's look at the actual mechanics of governing. Can a party survive long term if its internal factions are practically speaking different languages?
It's extremely difficult.
I mean, if you are a pragmatist trying to write a unified legislative platform, and your traditionalists want open borders for the free flow of labor and capital, and your populists want a sealed border for economic protectionism, how do you whip votes for a single bill?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it creates a state of near-permanent legislative paralysis. The structural reality is that the loss of the Reagan Electoral Coalition meant the GOP had to completely reinvent its campaign strategies across the country.
Right.
A populist message that drives massive voter turnout in a rural Ohio diner might be the exact same message that actively loses you a crucial congressional seat in the affluent suburbs of Atlanta.
Because it's not a monolith anymore.
No. The party is no longer the ideological monolith it was in 1985. It morphed into a fragile, highly combustible coalition of competing interests.
Held together by what?
Largely by shared cultural grievances and a unified opposition to the left.
It is a high-wire act in a hurricane. Now, if you are sitting in Europe listening to this right now, maybe you are commuting in Amsterdam or having coffee in London, you might be thinking, fascinating American drama, but how does this affect me?
Oh, it affects them?
Exactly. Let's answer that. Because what happens in the engine room of American politics never stays in America. Let's examine the ripple effect, the global consequences of this transformation.
The international fallout is perhaps the most consequential aspect of this entire shift. The internal ideological mutation of one single American political party fundamentally altered the architecture of global geopolitics.
Connect the dots for us. How does a shift from free trade and strong defense to America First, actually manifest on the streets of Europe or Asia?
It manifested through sudden, extreme unpredictability. First, European allies who had spent 70 years anchoring their own defense strategies to the reliability of the United States suddenly found themselves facing an entirely unpredictable partner.
Right.
The steady, predictable guarantor of Western security was suddenly questioning the value of the arrangement. Second, this led to intense, highly public debates over NATO financial contributions.
Because the populist framework views everything as a transaction.
Exactly. They didn't view NATO as a sacred brotherhood of democracies. They viewed it as a transactional contract where the U.S. was being financially ripped off by its allies.
And when you start treating a military alliance like a bad real estate deal, you threaten the actual mechanism of how alliances work, which is deterrence.
Yes. Deterrence is a psychological mechanism. It only works if the adversary believes, with absolute 100% certainty, that you will honor your treaty and defend your ally.
Right.
The moment a populist leader publicly muses about whether the U.S. should actually pay to defend a small NATO country, the psychological certainty of deterrence shatters. Even if not a single troop is moved, the damage to the security architecture is done.
So the foundation cracks just from the rhetoric. What else?
Third, new and sudden trade conflicts erupted. And not just with adversaries like China, but with historical allies in Europe and North America. The introduction of tariffs on allied steel and aluminum disrupted global supply chains overnight. And fourth, there was a rapidly shifting set of geopolitical priorities. The U.S. was signaling it was no longer interested in spending its blood and treasure to manage the liberal global order if it didn't perceive an immediate, tangible benefit to the homeland.
The scale of consequence here is staggering when you really map it out. We are talking about a debate happening at an American diner in the Midwest, two guys arguing over a closed auto plant and demanding trade protection, and that specific local anger ultimately changing defense spending strategies in the halls of Berlin and Paris.
It's the butterfly effect on steroids.
Exactly. It forces European capitals to scramble for strategic autonomy because they realize the American umbrella might have holes in it. Expand on how terrifying this unpredictability is for international diplomacy, which usually relies on decades of boring, steady consistency.
Unpredictability is the absolute nightmare scenario for international diplomacy. Mm. Treaties, global supply chains, semiconductor manufacturing, military defense postures, these things take decades to build.
Right.
They are predicated on the assumption that even if the ruling political party in a superpower changes from right to left, the foundational geopolitical goals remain relatively stable.
You expect the ship to maybe steer slightly left or slightly right, depending on who wins the election, but you trust it's still generally heading north.
Precisely. But the transformation we are analyzing wasn't a slight steering adjustment. It was a mutiny that threw the compass overboard. When America First became the embedded doctrine of half the American political system, allies realized they could no longer trust that agreements signed yesterday would be honored tomorrow.
If the domestic populist mood shifted.
Right. It forced every nation on Earth to develop contingency plans for a world where the United States might simply walk away from the table.
So an internal civil war within the Republican Party literally rewrote the risk assessment algorithms for the entire globe.
It really did.
Having established the massive domestic and global impacts, the deep dive turns to the ultimate question posed by the dossier. What happens next? We look at the post-Trump reality. Is this the new normal?
That is the core question. Is Trump a temporary anomaly, a blip on the historical radar caused by a unique personality, or the dawn of a completely new era?
And when we look at the structural mechanics, what is the verdict?
While the definitive answer is unknown, the text offers three scenarios for the GOP's future.
Okay, let's look at the scenarios. Scenario one.
Scenario one is total dominance. In this future, Trumpism remains dominant. The populist transformation is absolute. The party continues to double down on America First policies, aggressive economic protectionism, and relentless populist mobilization.
So it fully abandons classic conservatism.
Yes, viewing it as a relic of a failed past and solidifies itself purely as a working class nationalist labor party.
The hacker completely deletes the old operating system and builds a new one. Scenario two.
Scenario two is the restoration. This envisions a future where the party eventually recoils from the chaos of populism and attempts a return to traditional conservatism. A new generation of leaders successfully argues that protectionism failed, and they return to a renewed focus on free trade, strong institutional respect, and traditional alliances.
The IT department kicks the hacker out and reinstalls the classic operating system. But from a purely mechanical standpoint, how likely is that restoration?
Structurally, it is considered highly unlikely. The voter base has changed too drastically. Which brings us to scenario three, the hybrid model.
Okay, and what does that look like?
Observers deem this the most likely mechanical outcome for the future of the party. It attempts to synthesize the surviving elements. It features economic pragmatism. It won't be the pure, unregulated free trade of the 1990s, but it also steps back from total isolationist protectionism.
Right.
Culturally, it maintains a massive undercurrent of national conservatism and identity politics, because that is what drives voter turnout. But it attempts to pair that energy with the classic conservative desire for deregulation.
And on the global stage.
It adopts strategic internationalism,
yeah,
engaging with the world and maintaining alliances,
mm-hmm,
but with a much sharper, more ruthlessly transactional focus on American interests.
A compromise born of necessity.
Mm-hmm.
But regardless of whether it's pure dominance or a hybrid model, there is a very firm ultimate conclusion in the dossier about the legacy of this era.
The dossier's ultimate conclusion is that the Republican Party will never be the same. The transformation is a permanent mutation of the party's DNA.
Let me push back on that. Challenge the word permanent.
Hmm.
Because in politics, nothing ever feels permanent. The pendulum always swings back, right? So the genie is out of the bottle. Even if someone wanted to go back to 1985 Ronald Reagan, the voters simply wouldn't let them.
The mechanics of the voter coalition would absolutely reject it.
Really?
Yes. The voters who prioritize national identity, strict borders, and economic protection for the working class now make up too large and too vocal a segment of the primary base. The classic conservative model fundamentally failed to address their material realities. And for a decade, they have tasted a politics that speaks directly to their grievances and validates their anger. You cannot unring that bell.
Wow.
You cannot force a working class coalition to care about macroeconomic corporate tax theory once they've realized their collective power to demand protective tariffs. The 2015 to 2029 period wasn't just about a president. It was the transformation of a political era. Even if future leaders adopt a polite, quiet style, those underlying themes are permanently embedded.
Think about how fast this happened. I want you, the listener, to really think about this for a final reflection. In less than a decade, one of the most powerful political institutions on Earth completely rewrote its genetic code.
It's astounding.
It swapped out its foundational pillars while the building was still occupied. And it leaves you wondering, if a foundational institution can transform this rapidly under the pressure of its voters, what other unshakable institutions in our society are just one spark away from a total rewrite?
It's a great question. Because the mechanics of disruption are clearly highly contagious.
They are. And this transformation we talked about today, it wasn't just about trade deals and tax brackets. It bled outward. It bled into our schools, our churches, and our own personal identities.
The political became profoundly personal.
And that is exactly where we are heading next. Next time on The Deep Dive, we are opening up Chapter 5 of the dossier to explore the new American culture war. We're going to unpack the intense battle lines drawn over woke versus anti-woke ideology, the shifting roles of universities and religion, fierce gender debates, and how, ultimately, political differences transformed into deeply personal identity differences. You won't want to miss it.
It promises to be an equally vital analysis.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the world around you, and we'll see you next time.